So as I mentioned, today is going to be a different day. The service is going to look quite different. And I want to take just a moment to introduce today's, I'm not going to be speaking at length, but I want to introduce where we're going, what we're doing. We've been talking through a series on justice. We've been exploring the themes of what it means to understand how God is just and what that impact has on us as we pursue Him and a life with Him. And today, really, we want to have an opportunity to hear different voices. I think every preacher reaches a point in a sermon series or over their course of preaching where they say, this is something I can teach from the Bible, but in terms of my own experience, it's more limited than I'd like. And we, across our three sites, wanted to be able to hear from people who've been deeply involved in justice ministries. And so today, we've each site pastor has had an interview with a different person. And we're all, across our three sites, watching the same video interviews. Each is about 10 minutes or less, and that will sort of comprise our teaching, because you're going to be hearing from people who are deeply involved in practicing justice on an everyday basis. And I'm really thrilled for us that we get to hear from such exceptional people. In the midst of this, we're going to hear from Cheryl Millman at Open Doors, which is a ministry that reaches out to women who are incarcerated or on their way out transitioning from jail. We're also going to hear from Terry LeBlanc, who is Indigenous and has a lot of leadership in the area of dealing with the First Nations people and faith and all of that, which is a fascinating interview. And finally, we'll hear from Lennett Anderson, who is down in the Halifax area. Some of you men will recognize his name. He was at our men's conference back a month or so ago. And he'll be talking about things, from an African-American perspective, and sharing some of those things. Just excellent interviews, a real gift to the church to be able to hear all these voices on this theme. Just as we come into that, I want to give a little bit of a preface and an introduction by reminding you of a verse of Scripture we've been focusing on quite heavily. That's Micah 6:8. It kind of summarizes a lot of the theme of justice for us. He, God, has shown you, O mortal, we're all the mortals, by the way. He, God, has shown you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. And so we've been pursuing what it means to act justly, to live that life out every day. And I want to show you three pictures that help us to understand this, and especially our three interviews today. The first picture is one of equality. You see here in this picture, there are three different people of different heights who are all trying to watch a soccer game. And there's a fence between them and the soccer game. Now, this picture is entitled Equality because everyone is given the same thing. Everyone is given a box to stand. Although you can see the problem, can't you? The taller boy, he's able to see. The shorter girl, she's still able to see. But the shortest, well, he's got a box just like them, but it's not adequate for his needs. Now, in the second picture here, we see equity. Equity is when everyone is given what they need to be able to participate. And those differences are accommodated. So now the tallest boy, he's able to see. The middle girl, she has one box and she's able to see. And the smallest has two boxes so that he's able to see. Now everyone is able to participate. Now many times when I've heard people talk about justice, this is the sense of what justice is. It means that everyone's given what they need to participate, to make it right. But actually we need to go a step further because justice deals with the obstacles and barriers, okay? So the third picture here, you see that the fence has been changed. Now nobody needs anything to be able to participate. The floor has been leveled, so to speak. Each one of them is able to participate in that experience without any hindrance or obstacle, without having to be accommodated. The barrier has been removed. Now, the three individuals that we're going to be hearing from today, each one of them is dealing with an obstacle and a barrier from a different perspective. Racial bias, history, and also the experience of incarceration due to the consequences of bad behavior. But each one of these things creates a barrier, and real justice in each of these three circumstances and perspectives means eliminating the barrier, not simply accommodating for the problem. So Christians, as we pursue justice, it means that we need to see what barriers exist and help to knock those barriers down, not simply to create equity. Now that concept, I hope, will help you understand some of our conversation today. That's as far as I'm going to take that. But we're going to hear now from three different voices. Between each video, we'll take a moment to catch our breath, to pause, reflect, and to sing so that we're able to sort of take it in chunks and chunks as we go. So the first video is from Cheryl Millman. She'll introduce herself a little bit. Please direct your attention to the screen.
Well, Cheryl, could you give us a brief explanation of what is Open Door Outreach all about?
Open Door Outreach works with women who are marginalized by addiction and incarceration. And we do most of our work in the correctional center. We're in there Monday to Thursday, several times a day, meeting with women and doing programs, and then we work with them post-release as well.
Could you paint us a picture of what these women look like? Each of their stories is unique, but what are some of the common stories that you hear?
I would say about probably 95% of the women that we've met and talked with and heard their stories, there is some form of trauma in their childhood. And it could be the darkest things you've ever heard in your life, or it could be being kicked out of their home, and when they're 14 years old, things like that is very common in most of their stories.
Justice is a complex theme. How do you see it get played out in their lives?
Well, they are part of the justice system, and so from my point of view as a minister, as a Christian, the justice system has to be just. When you commit a crime, you have to do the time, and no matter whether you think that your sentence is harsh or somebody else's has got a better sentence than you did and their crime was more harsh, it doesn't matter in the end, because you have to do the time. And so the justice issue for them, though, is that there are many places in their lives, whether it be in their family life or in working with social services and their families or their partners or whatnot, where they've had great injustice done to them, and their response often is to act out because something was done to them, and therefore they have a right to do the things that they're doing, to act out the way they did. Then they end up in jail, and we confront them about their behaviors and their values and their thinking and how that is going to either have to change in order for them to operate in this world, or we will see them back in jail again. So there's two things going on. There's an injustices that have been done to them, but then they feel that gives them a right to be unjust to other people, whether it be their partner, their children, or their family, or society.
Well, in what ways, Cheryl, do you see the Christian faith speaking to those who've suffered injustice? Often these are the same people who've suffered injustice, but also maybe have perpetrated injustice.
We have the unique position of doing life skills programs every Tuesday, which is just what it says. It's about life skills, how to create boundaries, how to have a good relationship, and so on and so forth. And then we have the other side where we're chaplains and we're able to have chapel and Bible study, where we continually speak into their lives about the misconceptions that they have about who God is. And so it's an awesome responsibility, and it's like the full meal deal. And in that, we're forever confronting people about you are here for a reason, but this is not who you are, okay? You've done crime. You might be living in an addiction and doing a lot of hurtful things to yourself and to the community. But this person that I see sitting in front of me in the chapel or in the resource room or wherever is not who you are. So our responsibility is to say, this is who God really is. This is how much he loves you. This is what he's done for you. I have a cross behind me on the wall that says that he loves you that much that he died for you. And even though you have a choice in the things that you're doing, he's forever calling you and seeking after you and wanting to give you another chance and another chance and another chance. But you must remember that someday your chances might run out because you're living a very dangerous life. So we have to confront where they're at and what they've done. Like, you're in jail, okay? But this is not who you are. And this is why we feel this way.
Do you see any misconceptions that the average churchgoer has about these women?
Well, this is going to sound really weird, but just because someone says a sinner's prayer doesn't mean that their life has changed. And if that is our only goal as a church, is to get people to say the sinner's prayer, then we've missed it. Because we haven't gotten to know the person, gotten to know them by name, and have a relationship with them. And that's what God does for us. He comes into relationship with us. He's after our heart. And there was a time in my life, in my early days, when I was trained, that was the way that the church dealt with anybody who wasn't a Christian, especially people who were in very dire situations. But I've discovered that a lot of people already know that it makes church people really happy if you pray this prayer. And so they'll pray it, right? Because it makes me happy, and I'll continue to visit them, right? And so we don't encourage people to give their heart to the Lord. We encourage them to encounter Jesus, and through that, they say to us, I would like to have Jesus in my life. We're like, really? Okay.
I think that sometimes people look at women who are in prison and say justice means that someone who's done something wrong gets punished. But I think what I hear you describing in your ministry is, and tell me if I'm right or wrong, is that justice means giving women who have been suffered as well at the hands of other people a new opportunity to start again. Mm-hmm. And to, yes, deal for what they've done wrong, but also to create a life that is healthy and balanced and a productive part of society. Could you comment to serve along those lines?
Well, Jesus talked a lot about justice issues, and that when he came, he in Isaiah, it says that a bruised reed he would not snuff out. And that's what our women are, and many marginalized women are, like a bruised reed. And that was never his intention to hurt people any more than they're already hurt. It's not enough.
I'll also say that there are times when we need to stand up for our ladies as they're getting out. We need to help them in different ways where people are not listening to them. Sometimes we have to go to appointments with them. Sometimes we have to coach them to stand up for themselves or to be less aggressive with their with the way they deal with people in society. So in that way, we serve as we can help them on the outside with the injustices of their lives.
Cheryl, you can't always say the gospel clearly and articulately as some people might like to think. So how do you be the hands and feet of Jesus to these women in the prison in the midst of all of that?
Jesus said, when I was in prison, you visited me. He didn't say, when I was in prison, you had a Bible study with me. He said, you visited me. So the fact that we're there and we show up when we say we're going to show up, when we do what we say we're going to do, and we bring his love with that. We don't do this because we want something from you. We want your salvation. We do it because Jesus tells us to go. And when they tell us later that we're non-judgmental, then that blows me away, because the Church of Jesus Christ is known for being judgmental, right? Everything from our hair to our clothing to where we go and what we say and what we do, right? We tend to be that way. And when they said that about us, I was like, well, this is definitely Jesus. He has shown up in us, and we didn't even have to have a come to Jesus meeting.
So my name is Terry LePong, and together with my wife, Bev, we live here just south of Montague, PEI. We've been here just a little over 5 years now, and have just celebrated our 48th wedding anniversary.
Congratulations.
Yeah, just a week and a half ago. So I'm the executive director for Indigenous Pathways, which is this umbrella for the two ministries, iEmergence and NAITS, an Indigenous Learning Community. But most of my time is spent with NAITS, an Indigenous Learning Community, which is a graduate and postgraduate theological studies program.
Kind of more of a personal reflection. Could you help us understand just some of the realities as a Mi'kmaq person and what life is like that way, and some of the unique opportunities and challenges that comes from that?
Well, so we're going to be here for several hours. Well, not unlike many in my generation, we grew up with a collage of experiences and understandings of what it meant to be a Mi'kmaq person that were handed down to us by our parents' generation in some respects. The historic prejudices towards Indigenous peoples in Canada that still exist in many places. The exclusionary experience, you're excluded on one hand from mainstream society, and yet on the other hand you're expected to integrate within mainstream society, and so there are these sort of conflicting sorts of feelings and experiences about that, where your parents tried very much to help you integrate and forget your indigeneity so that you could become functional, right, as it were, and accepted in mainstream society. And then on the other hand, attempts to do that being rebuffed by mainstream society because you were Indigenous. Right. So in a sense, if you'll pardon the expression, you were damned if you did and damned if you didn't.
Yeah.
So there were those sorts of conflicting feelings that you grew up with. If you lived in a mainstream identity, which I could because I looked the way I do, people were very accepting of you. But the moment you unpack the fact that you're a Mi'kmaq person, it's like,
sure,
they would distance themselves, or there would be some new frame that they would put around your life. For a lot of our folk who not because of lack of competence, but developed skill, if you will, who weren't able to navigate that, it was incredibly oppressive experience, and incredibly demeaning experience at times. You felt completely incompetent and unacceptable. And for me as a follower of the Jesus way, I learned to follow Jesus from Euro-Canadian folk,
sure,
who had followed Jesus years and years and years already before us. And as we set about to follow Jesus, it was implicit and explicit in the way we experienced it, you needed to be Euro-Canadian in your lifestyle, your understandings of culture, etc., in order to be an authentic follower of Jesus. If you talked about culture other than Euro-Canadian culture, you were looked at with suspicion. You can't do that. You can't be that and be a follower of Jesus. And so you were forced into this choice: either be a follower of Jesus or be an Indigenous person. Because you couldn't be those two things together.
Yes.
And so that was our early experience, and so we fell in love with Jesus, so we just did what they suggested.
Sure.
And it was not until I was working as a youth chaplain with the Agassiz Center for Youth in Manitoba where I began to really question that. because I was inviting kids in the youth detention center who are indigenous to do the same thing.
Right.
And it became really obvious that that was foolish.
Mm.
And it wasn't what God asked us to
yeah.
do. It wasn't part of the preaching of the gospel, and it wasn't
right.
part of what it meant to become followers of Jesus. So we ask questions like, you know, why would God call us to leave one sin-stained culture to enter another sin-stained
sure.
culture?
Yeah.
You know, prior to that, there was this imagining that Western culture, Euro-Canadian or Euro-American or whatever, was uniquely disposed to being Christian.
Right.
What was intriguing for me was how the church could move from Acts 15 in the experience of the Gentile church as it emerges, being told by the believers from the sect of the Pharisees that they needed to become Jews in order to become followers of Jesus, how that could turn around in 100 years and the exact opposite experience be true 100 years later, where the Gentiles were saying to the Jews, you need to be Gentile in order to be followers of Jesus.
Wow. Yeah.
And then if you examine the trajectory of the church from that point to the present, in fact, in some cases, you find that continuing phenomenon.
How has the church dropped the ball? Where gleams of hope and how the church operates today?
I think the way forward is to have a conversation, not unlike what we're doing right here.
Sure.
Have a conversation that isn't filled with suspicion as a first lens.
Yeah.
Where there's an immediate question. I wonder if he's a real Christian. Mm. Could you give me your testimony?
Right. Yeah.
You know, which I've gotten, I don't know how many times over the years, when I say something that flies in the face of what people in the Western church believe, they almost inevitably want to, you know, when were you baptized?
Mm.
Could you tell me how you came to faith?
Yeah.
As if somehow I'm not an authentic follower
sure.
of Jesus. So conversations like this are helpful.
Mm.
Yeah. So I applaud you for doing this. There are a lot of people who still have the idea that was then, this is now, get over it.
Sure.
And inevitably I find myself saying, which one do you want us to get over?
Mm.
Since it wasn't just one event or one circumstance, and since it wasn't in just one year, but it's been over a period of 150 years, I invite people to look at, for example, the legislation in Canada that dealt with and still deals with Indigenous people that is very prejudicial, and then ask, what do you want us to get over?
Yeah.
And then the second thing I would say when people say get over it and get on with it, I'd say, well, that's a view of time that suggests that as soon as we move through the present moment, everything in the past has no
sure.
relevance.
Yeah.
And that's certainly not true. And for Christians, we should think differently. Since the very text that we consult on a daily basis in our devotions and preach from on a Sunday-by-Sunday basis is a text of the past. And I mean, it's not a text of the present in terms of its when it was written, in terms of the events it writes about, in terms of the people it writes about. Those are all dead and gone. Why do we continue to consult it? Because it speaks to us in the present moment.
Right.
And because the Spirit enlivens it in the present moment. How much more so our history as a people together?
Mm.
How much more should we consult our past
right.
and say, how did we get here?
Mm.
What does it mean for us today?
Yeah.
So instead of the future focus that the Western church has had,
sure.
and its eschatology has driven it,
yes,
almost painstakingly driven it into an unknown and unknowable future, with then a consequent ignoring of the past, which they see is behind it, let's bring the past out in front and ask some authentic
right.
questions.
Yeah.
How did we get here?
Yeah.
What did we do that got us here? And how do we unpack that so that we don't do it again?
Right.
So I always say to my students, it's not that we won't make mistakes as we move forward, but let's at least have the integrity to make new ones. A significant error that we make as human beings is an assumption that if we acknowledge something took place, that we can now move into this new place, without understanding that the consequences of what happened are still with us.
Yes.
Like we're still living those out. Many Indigenous peoples today are still living out the consequences of those things. And so to say, okay, let's start fresh from this point forward. Now that we've acknowledged it, let's start fresh and move on,
right.
is very unrealistic.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't allow that these consequences continue to impact the lives of Indigenous people. I think as we move forward in Indigenous and non-Indigenous relationships, it's that kind of thinking that we need to engage. And what were the circumstances there? How do we deal with those so that moving forward, we give everyone the opportunity to live into health and well-being? I think that's what it would look like.
Wow.
Okay. Leonard Anderson, my name. Born and raised in the community of Upper Hammers Plains, just outside of Halifax. I am a son, and I am a husband to Kaysa Monroe Anderson from the Bahamas. We have three amazing kids, Micah, Caleb, and my baby girl, Jordan. And so that's who I am. I'm pastoring at Emmanuel Baptist Church. Last month marked my 20th anniversary there, and so it's been an amazing journey to see the mosaic that God is building in the kingdom. I'm a retired chaplain after serving 20 years with the forces, and that's me in a nutshell. Yeah.
Your church is pretty special in that it has people from all over the planet that gather under one roof. Tell us a little bit about that dynamic where cultures, people, stories, backgrounds, all in one roof, worshiping Christ. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that community of faith.
Nothing moves my heart like a Sunday morning worship experience. Sometimes you can become very emotional to look out and see the diversity of the kingdom. It's a representation of the kingdom that in a historical black community in Nova Scotia, a historic African Nova Scotian community, there are 28 ethnicities that are gathering to worship under one roof. We're only about 400, 425, but to have that mosaic, to have that demographic represented, it's a special thing. I don't even have the vocabulary to describe, really, because of the history in Nova Scotia, the racial tension, the societal ills. And in 2019, to see those walls coming down and to see the unity in the community of faith, I mean, I can brag about it all day. It moves my heart. It brings such joy and excitement that this is the Lord's doing. But he died, you know, to tear down the middle wall. No longer male, female, Jew, Gentile, bond. You know, it's just, yeah.
What would you say to the Christ follower that struggles with, I know it's wrong to oppress people. I know it's wrong to leave the ones in the margins in the margins. How do we effectively speak into structures and people that promote the gospel and honor the individuals at the same time?
As a Christ follower, we have to follow Christ. And I don't think you can look at the ministry and the life of Jesus and not see him running to the margins. Every time. Maybe it's through my lens, but when I open the Holy Writ and I see the movement in the text, I see a Jesus that is moved with compassion, that when he sees the marginalized, the ostracized, that's where he moves. Whether it's the woman at the well and no one else is there, that's where he moves intentionally. Whether it's the lepers, that's where he moves. You know, the blind Bartimaeus, the lame, and even in telling the story of the Good Samaritan, how the priest saw and kept on walking, the Levite saw and kept on walking, and then this Samaritan, this mixed race man, saw and was moved with compassion. You know, we say, break my heart for what breaks yours. And so I think to be people of faith is to realize that faith is both a noun and a verb. Faith is both what we believe and is how we live because of what we believe. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the German theologian, once said, and I quote him all the time, silence in the face of evil is evil itself. Not to speak is to speak. Not to act is to act. I like the Micah 6. What does the Lord require of thee, O man? You know, but to do justly, you know, to love mercy and to walk humbly. Hear the action. Act justly. Act morally, fairly. humanely, act justly, love mercy. I also love Amos 5, that all that justice would roll down like a mighty river, like a never-ending stream. That's just a force. And I believe that if the church understood, we have biblical grounds. This is what the scriptures calls us to do. I don't know how you read Isaiah chapter 1 and not see in verse 17, seek justice, oppose this, defend the widow. This is, and so it's not about charity, because I believe churches have great outreach initiatives. We're going to, soup kitchens and prisons, and we really, that's our heartbeat. But I guess I struggle, Phil, in that I want us to know why we're doing it, and to not get caught up in charity, but to get caught up in justice. For me, charity is what can we do? Justice is why.
Help the listener on the why. Why do we do that?
Why do we do that? Well, we said first, our biblical foundation is that we're Christ followers. I don't know of a time where he remained silent and did not address. You know, even when they had grounds for her stoning. Let me just get down in the sand. Oh, yes, you without sin. like call people on their stuff. And so we, you know, how do we seek justice and act justly? Because it's one thing to know it, it's another thing to do it. And we will never change what we don't confront, right? And so why do we do it? Because we want to be light in darkness.
Give us some examples of how you have done that in your life.
If we're relational, if we believe that God so loved the world, it has to be relational. I can't have an effective ministry of reconciliation if I'm offending everyone, cutting everyone off, telling them what they're doing wrong. How do we grow together? Right? And many times it's ignorance. I didn't know that phrase was inappropriate. It was not intentional to cause. But look to build community. Seek to build community. That would be my challenge to every Christian church. Because why have the church in the community if the community isn't in the church? Mm. Right? Sesame Street. It's the people that you meet when you're walking down the street. Who are the people in your neighborhood, right? We need to get to know the people in our neighborhood, because why do ministry? Anyway, that's a whole nother. I get an attitude when people can do missions in Cuba and in Asia and Africa, but can't do justice down the street.
The last question I want to ask you is, what would you say to Cornerstone Baptist, our church family, our three sites, on issues of justice in their own individual lives, with the people that they meet as they walk down their own streets? What would you say to encourage them in this whole conversation?
I say to Cornerstone Baptist and all three sites, four words: be just, bring justice. I won't be stuck in a monument, my church. I'm going to be a part of his movement. Because whenever Jesus saw it, he ran to the margins.
Thank you, my friend.
Love you, bro.
Appreciate that.